Okay. Get a little hoarse.
You just let us know when you're ready. Mm-hmm.
I come alive after I have my coffee in the morning.
Another feeling.
You're doing great. This mm-hmm. is wonderful. Okay, mm-hmm. ready?
Can we go back to 1942? We were speaking about Effa, and one of the things that we were reading was she is as a businesswoman and negotiating contracts, and that you had asked for a raise, and she had held the line, and that was one of the reasons you ended up going to Mexico. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I started, you know, in the start of the 1942 season, you know, playing and playing with Newark. In the meantime, I got this telegram from the Pascal brothers in Mexico that they'd like for me to come down there to play, and they were offering, as I mentioned earlier, a pretty good salary, you know, $500 a month, and $250 for a maid and an apartment. So I got the telegram and I showed it to Mrs. Manley. I said, you know, Mrs. Manley, this is the best team I've ever played on. You know, we had a super team. In fact, I remember that Easter in 1942, we opened up with the Homestead Grays at Griffith Stadium in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And we beat them, you know, badly, because we had a very balanced team, great speed, good pitching, you know, good defense, you know, a lot of power. All the guys were fairly young. And I said, I want to get married, and I'm only making $150 a month. Can you make it $175? I said, that's only $25 more. She said, oh no, Monty. She says, I've got you know, these other stars to pay. You're so young, and you've got you know, a long time. You'll be in baseball a long time. I said, well. Yeah, I said, I'm not concerned with them. I'm concerned about me, you know me. She said, no, I just can't do it. I said, well, if you don't, I'm gonna leave. I have to go. Well, she said, well, you just have to go because I can't do it. So what I'm saying is, for $25 more a month, you know, she let her, one of her best players, go to Mexico. And I think she's always sorry about that. Now, if we could just go back for a moment to the Ricky and Effa Manley situation. When she said she was going to sue Branch Rickey if he didn't, you know, give her some kind of, you know, payment, you know, for my services, because I was under contract to the Newark Eagles. And Ricky said, no. She said, what I'll do is release him. And so they released me from my contract, and then Horace Stoneman and the New York Giants picked me up back in 1948. I was playing in winter baseball in Cuba, wonderful place to play. Good salary, you know, didn't have to travel. Havana at that time was a great city, before Castro and all that. And I signed with the Giants, started in Jersey City in the International League, went to spring training with them. And then the 1st of July of that same year, I was called up to the parent club. And that's when, you know, that really everything really changed from then on. Now, in order to, I knew I was making more money now. I was making $6,000 a year now in the Negro Leagues. The minimum in the major leagues at that time was $5,000. So I took, you know, $1,000 cut. But I knew in the long run, you know, organized baseball, that was the, you know, place to play. And as it turned out, you know, I kept moving up, and next year, you know, was making eight, and then, you know, then later on 12-5, And then I had a great year in 1951. And owner and president, Horace Stone, called me in the office. And he said, Monty, you had a, you know, good season, and I want to, you know, how much money you want. So I had to think real fast. I said, Mr. Stone, you know, you and I, we've never had any problem with money. I said, whatever you think is fair, just like that. I threw the ball back in his court, you know. And he said, well, suppose I just double your salary, you know. And right away I said, well, that's fine, that's good, before he could change his mind. I said, that's good enough for me. Oh, so I signed, and 52, 53, 54, 55, I made the, you know, the $25,000. Now the top salary at that time was about 40. Nobody's making more than $40,000. I was like, you know, tops. Talking about, you know, Ralph Kiner and Stan Musial and you know, all the stars, Joe DiMaggio, those fellas, you know, they weren't making, you know, very much money. And of course, later on, you know, $100,000 became the, that was the, you know, absolute top. Nobody, you know, we're talking about DiMaggio and Williams and, you know, Musial and some couple other guys, Feller and all.
I believe it was Ruth who said he made more than the president, but he had better year.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Had a better year and less taxes. Yeah, that's right. And then, I've signed for $25,000, and then in spring training, playing in an exhibition game in Denver, getting ready, you know, to come back east to start the season. Had a terrible accident at third base. I slid and broke my ankle. And, you know, gee whiz, you know, what else could happen? But I told DeRoche, I said, Leo, I said, I heal fast. And I said, I'll be back. So later on, now that was April 2nd, 1952 in Denver, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I can't remember all the details. And took me to the hospital, you know, got my ankle set, and in about stayed out there for about a couple weeks, and brought me back to New York, put me in the hospital there, and I started my rehabilitation. Don't you know, with a compound fracture, got all the treatment, good therapy, you know, exercise and massage, and by August the 1st, I was playing.
Wow.
Playing again, you know, put on, instead of a baseball shoe, I'd wear a football shoe, you know, laced up so that, you know, wouldn't turn the ankle. And, I did get a chance to play a little bit, you know, from August 1st until, you know, the end of September. And, you know, gave me a little feeling about how much work I had to do, you know, to get back in top form. So I almost gained, you know, all my speed and power at the plate. And as I mentioned, I was able to play, you know, for the 25 until, until 1955. 1956, I was drafted by the Cubs, so I played with them at a reduced salary. I think I'm making about $16,000 now, from 25 to 16, which wasn't that bad again. Okay. And of course, you know, I had two kids, and, you know, wife and two kids. And Chicago, wonderful place to play because you played it was all day ball. There right. No lights at all in Chicago. Ernie Banks was just starting, and Big Bob Rush and Warren Hacker and some of these fellas, you know. But best team I ever played on that finished last. Yeah. Okay, now, you know, I'm 38, and they got some youngsters coming up. So now I went from there, started in the Pacific Coast League. Played with the with the Los Angeles Angels and hit the ball well and so on. So had a back, you know, old back kind of. Every time I'd play about the fifth or sixth inning, back would get stiff and I had to come out of the game. And I went to a famous orthopedic surgeon by the name of Dr. Bob Kerlan, K-E-R-L-A-N.
Okay.
And he's the man who became real famous because he's the one who worked on Sandy Koufax later on. He wasn't famous then, but later on he became real famous. He, you know, advised Sandy to soak his arm in a pail of cold water after game, and you know this really helped. So he said, took an X-ray, and he said, well, he said, I asked him, you know, what are my chances? You know, would I ever get well again? He said, well, it's 50-50. You know, he said, at your age, he said, I would advise an operation. I said, well, what caused it? He said, too many tackles, too many slides, and too many rebounds. So I said, well, I guess this is it. And I waited around Los Angeles for a couple of weeks, and I got in the car and drove back all the way from Los Angeles, you know, back to my home in Orange, New Jersey. And after, you know, sitting around for a while, I got a real good job with the Ryan Gobert Company.
Okay.
And in Brooklyn. So I worked with them until 1968. 1969, I went into the baseball commissioner's office under Bowie Kuhn, and I worked for him for 16 years. Retired in 1984, and from 84 until today, I've been living in Florida. So I've had 18 wonderful years of retirement. Wow. And just wonderful where I am down there in Florida, a little small town called Homosassa. That's where Mike Hampton, you know, the great pitcher,
okay.
From Denver, he lives there. And Ted Williams lives not too far away. And I got some other, you know, great players, Max Lanier, Hal Lanier, Gene Hermansky. These fellows live right there in my same area.
Sounds like you could have a pickup game down there.
Well, we get together and we talk about it. Yeah, we're kind of limited to that now. But you know, it's so good, and it's not crowded. You don't have to wait very long at the post office or at the bank. No traffic.
That's great.
So, but people now have found out about the area and have started to pour in there. So again, the problem is we need water. Yeah.
Taking you back to the Giants, you mentioned Leo DeRocher.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't mentioned Willie Mays yet. Wanted to just get your impressions of Leo and then maybe go position by position around the great Giants team you played for.
Mm-hmm. Well, with me, Hank Thompson was a third baseman, and he was, we both, you know, both call up in 1949, early July. And DeRocher now had, Leo DeRocher had been the manager for Brooklyn for a long time. Now he, signed with the Giants to manage the Giants. And he was one of the shrewdest and best managers I think I've ever played for. And now Willie Mays comes to our club, 1951. I think he's about 20 years old, and they brought him in. And we were playing in Philadelphia. I never will forget it. And this fine-looking youngster, you know, well-built and, you know, boyish, and brought him in the clubhouse. Leo took him around, introduced him to anybody. I think he was hitting almost 500 up there in Minneapolis, Minnesota, you know, in the American Association. And you could tell right away that he was a natural, diamond in the rough, so to speak. The way he would move, the way he would throw the ball away, he would catch the ball. He had flair, he had charisma.
Okay.
And sure enough, he didn't start out that much. You know, I'm to start out that well right at the beginning. I think he went to the plate maybe, you know, 13, 14, 15 times before he got, you know, before he got a base hit. But he caught everything that was hitting the outfield and threw everybody out that ran. So we won the three games, but he was a little down. He came in the clubhouse and he said, maybe I'm not ready, Leo, and maybe you better send me back to Minneapolis. So Leo said, not in your life. He said, you're my center fielder. He said, today, tomorrow, and forever. He said, you just go out there and play the way you're playing. He said, the home runs will come, the hits will come. Sure enough, that was like on a Thursday, Friday night, now we open up in the Polo Ground against the Braves, the Boston Braves at that time. Warren Spahn was the pitcher. First time up, Warren Spahn threw Willie a changeup, and he hit about 400 feet over that left field pavilion. And you know how many, you know, he's hit since then. About 660. So he was, again, a diamond in the rough, just need polishing. And Leo, you know, really polished him. Now, that was one of the, I think every player, every athlete should experience what we experienced that year. We won our first game, and I think we lost the next 11. Mm. And I think we're playing in Brooklyn. And, you know, the clubhouse is real close there in Brooklyn. And we could hear the guys, you know, the Dodger players saying, eat your heart out, Leo. You'll never win it this year. So DeRozier said, fellas, he said, this should be a great incentive for us now to get our act together and start to play. And to start to play, we did. Now we find ourselves in the middle of August, 13 and a half games behind. So we really got, you know, started to play well. Won about 16 in a row. And they brought Whitey Lockham in to play first base. I went to left field, Mays in center field. Bobby Thompson now was playing third base. We got our pitching staff squared away, you know, Magley, Jansen, Coslow, Hearn, Spencer, our reliever, and we started a roll. And last game of the season, we knew that if we, you know, went up to Boston and won our game, that at least, you know, we couldn't lose it. You know, it would end up in a tie, and sure enough, it did. And first game we opened up, and, you know, at that time we played a three-game series in the playoffs. First game in Ebbets Field, we beat the Dodgers. I think it was 3-1. Second game, they beat us 10-0. Clem Levine throwing that slinker and all, he shut us out 10-0. So now they had Big Don Newcomb, you know, as one of their star pitchers to open up the third game, and he had shut us out until the ninth inning. And first man up was, Alvin Dark. Alvin single, Don Mueller single. I'm now, you know, I had a good year. I want to keep the rally going, but trying to pull one of Newcomb's sliders into that left field stand, I foul out to Hodges. To now, what I say now is that I set it up for Bob Thompson. Right behind me, Lockman double. Whitey Lockman, double down left field line. And now, you know, that brings, it took Newcomb out, brought in Ralph Branca, and Bob Thompson is the hitter. First pitch, high fastball right inside, you know, pitch that Bobby likes. Second pitch, the same place, and Bobby whacked it. All of a sudden now, we looked at each other and realized that we're the, you know, National League champions. And then everybody rushed to home plate, okay? And we really celebrated, okay? We go into the clubhouse, and what had happened, we thought that, you know, there's no way we could catch them or anything. So around the, you know, I guess around the seventh inning, they took the champagne and put it away. Took it off ice and put it away. And then when Bob Thompson hit the home run, they had to get it out real quick, you know, to try to re-chill it. So we drank warm champagne. Willie Mays had never, he had never drunk champagne before. And he said, what is this funny tasting stuff? Give me a Coke. Meantime, now Don Newcomb, who had started the game, he was in the clubhouse, you know, he's in the shower. And he didn't even know that we had won. So the, some of the newspaper and the cameraman came in to get the camera. So he said, Newcomb said, what are you doing? He said, the Giants win. He said, the hell they did. He said, Don, believe me. He said, they just won it. So he came out and found out that we had. So, okay, now we're, you know, really celebrating. And I remember Pee Wee Reese, you know, shortstop for the Dodgers, came over. And he said, you know, I just don't, I can't, I don't believe that you guys have won it. So the, one of the paper, newspaper guys said, well, Pee-wee, they won it, as you know. And he says, well, I'm going to Yankee Stadium tomorrow just as if we did. He said, don't go, Pee-wee, because you'd be the only Dodger, only Dodger there. So we laughed at that. Now, again, so we had Whitey Lockman playing first base. We had Eddie Stanky playing second, Alvin Dark playing third, and Bob Thompson, who came up as a third baseman, was playing third. Had Wes Westrum was the catcher, and Don Mueller was playing right field. I was playing left, and of course the great Willie Mays was playing center. So we had a balanced club, and had speed, had defense, you know, had power, and we had a good pitching staff. Again, Magley, Jansen, and Coslow and Hearn, Jim Hearn. So he never, when we were behind, Leo never said, let's catch him. He never said that. And that was key because he always said, let's see how close we can come, fellas, you know. You know, if, you know, that's every day, you know, let's go out and let's go. He said, let's get after him every day. And, you know, we just kept winning and kept winning. And, you know, we finally wound up in a tie. And during that streak, we had the wives were, you know, extra nice. They were cooking things that, you know, that each one of us liked. We had ministers and priests lighting candles for us, you know. People saying special prayers, and wow. Fans were, you know, rooting, and it was just a wonderful, wonderful chase, you know, to see if we could do it. And then when Bob Thompson hit that home run, and we realized that we were the champions. The greatest feeling one of the greatest feelings I've ever had. I tell you, put an extra $5,000 in our pockets, which was a lot of money at that time. And you know, going into the World Series, and every time I see Bob Thompson, I think about you know, I have a warm feeling for him because that was just a magnificent achievement. In fact, it was one of the most memorable moments in baseball. I think it was voted one year as the, you know, the most memorable moment for the, because the, you know, the feat wasn't anticipated. Giants, you know, against the Dodgers, you know, arch rivals, and last time at bat, coming from behind, you know, after being 13 and a half games behind, this was just a great, great thing. And
read at one point, mm-hmm. when Bobby's circling the bases, you were watching Jackie watching, yeah. Bobby.
Oh, yeah. I was sitting there, you know, when Bob hit the home run, he was, you know, circling the bases. People in the stands were jumping up and down. And some fans had started to come on the field. And I noticed the fact that as Bob Thompson was rounding the bases, Jackie stood there with, you know, with his you know, with his glove in his hand, and he's watching, you know, I guess trying to make sure that, you know, Bob touched every base. As if he hadn't, you know, what umpire would have had guts enough to, you know, say. And then while Ralph walking off the mound, Ralph Branca walking off the mound, you know, and so, you know, saying, you know, why should it happen to me? You know, I haven't done anything to deserve this. And so that was all. And in fact, I had that picture at home, and I, every once in a while, I'll take a look at it. Now, later on, some, you know, all these years, 50 years later, they only said that, you know, we were getting the signs, and you know, the Giants didn't really win it. You know, you did win it because you were doing something illegal. Well, doing it, you know, from the beginning of baseball, signs have been stolen, you know, by the coaches, or, you know, by somebody. Well, anyhow, we had gotten a few signs during the course of the season, but that game we want to win it, you know, on our own, and because remember now, we open up in Brooklyn, we won the game there. Now they move over to the Polo Grounds, and they beat us down 10-0, and next game they were, you know, winning 4-1 in the ninth inning. And if we were getting the signs, we weren't doing a very good job, anyhow.
Were you surprised that Branca came into the game? Hadn't Bobby Thompson hit him?
We were surprised that Charlie Dressen, you know, had taken Newcomb out. We thought, you know, maybe, you know, he's a big, strong fella, but, you know, Newcomb had been pitching real hard, and I think Dressen went out to the mound and said, you know, how you feel? He said, well, if you got anybody else, you know, ready, he said, you know, I'll leave. And they brought in Ralph. Now, the reason why they selected Ralph was because he was, you know, throwing the ball well, throwing strikes, and they had Carl Erskine, their other ace right-hander, warming up, but he was breaking the ball, and it was you know, the ball had gotten away from the catcher a couple of times, had to stop the game to retrieve the ball and all, so his control was off. Charlie